Hello, everyone. I'm an indigenous elder of the Eastern Cherokee and Muscogee tribes, and you're listening to the Awakened Underground podcast.
This podcast represents the opinions and experience of its hosts and guests for educational and informational purposes only.
Psychedelic plant medicines are sacred technologies that have been stewarded by indigenous people around the world since before recorded history.
As these indigenous wisdoms enter the mainstream culture, we ask you to please operate from a place of respect
and reciprocity as to end the exploitation and colonization of First Nations people.
It's imperative to use immense caution when embarking on your journey to work with psychedelic medicines,
as they are powerful tools for human transformation that are not to be taken lightly.
Information shared within this podcast should not be taken as medical advice.
Awakened Underground, its guests, and partners are not liable for any actions of your choosing.
With that said, we trust you will make responsible and ethical choices under your own free will.
What's up, gang? I'm your host, Cody Blue, and this episode's called Healing Work.
This is your brain on drugs.
This is your brain on drugs.
America's public enemy number one.
To a new and dangerous area, the use of hallucinogens.
Bad trip. A bummer, a freak out, even a flip out.
Don't let drugs ruin your future.
Both call it not a war on drugs, but a war on
consciousness.
You are now entering the Awakened Underground Podcast.
The father and the son are fascinating archetypes, as well as the mother and the daughter, the creator and the created, the teacher and the student. Watching my parents, I got front row seats to learning what it takes to be a successful artist. But those seats were shrouded in a very large shadow, and the pressure of the proverbial shoes I had to fill weighed on me ever since I can remember. The main tenets of my father's recipe for success were simple. Single-minded focus. Eliminate all outside noise and dedicate your life to one singular goal. Keep a positive attitude, work hard, and do not stop until you achieve your dream. I absorbed this blueprint like a sponge, and when I discovered my calling as a filmmaker in high school, I put this recipe for success into place to a T. But what I did not know was that some of the ingredients to this recipe were not health foods and would cause me problems over time. My senior year in high school, I began omitting anything from my life that wasn't in service of my aspirations as a director and screenwriter. I dropped off of all of my sports teams, stopped training in jiu-jitsu, and quit the hardcore band I was the vocalist for. I hung a poster of an Oscar above my bed, so it was the first and last thing I saw every day. And from that point forward, my goal was to log as many hours as possible immersed in my craft, watching, reading, and making films, to try and achieve the 10,000 hours of work my father told me I would need to reach in order to master my medium. This strategy made perfect sense to me at the time, as I believed sprinting to this 10,000-hour mark would give me a head start on the competition. But unbeknownst to me, I was indoctrinating myself into a cult of workaholism. One by one, I systematically shedded all the things I loved that weren't associated with my dream as a filmmaker. Every morning, I popped an Adderall and hyper-focused on my dream. I isolated myself away from my friends and my family, working every day until my vision blurred, my head ached, and my will braked as I crashed from the Adderall. Almost every night, my friends or family had to literally peel me away from the computer screen. I wish I saw what was happening to me at the time and made a change before it was too late. But the sad truth is, I saw this work ethic as a virtue and a character trait of all the great artists and athletes I admired. And you know what? It worked. It really worked. And I was able to achieve a tremendous amount of success at a very young age. But this lifestyle and mentality eventually caught up to me once I moved to Hollywood and me and my team sold our first film to New Line Cinema. As I unwittingly contractually locked myself into what would become 7 long years of development hell at the Warner Brothers studio. I no longer was in the driver's seat of my childhood dream, and I was now at the mercy of a massive, monolithic, apathetic studio that ate artists' dreams like mine for breakfast. This curse was also a blessing, as I could no longer escape into work, and I was forced to look inward and address my mental health problems I was experiencing from the pharmaceutical medications I was placed on as a child. With the money gained from the sale of the script, I went on a journey to find true medicine, and as you all know, I eventually found myself in the heart of the Amazon rainforest, working with the master teacher plants. I went there with an intention to heal, but I held within me a higher goal of healing to become the best filmmaker and artist I could be. When I entered my first ayahuasca ceremony, I was excited to finally experience what I had been reading and hearing about for so many years. But when the medicine took hold, I was suddenly taken aback by its intensity, sacredness, intelligence, and reality. I began to sweat as a high-pitched frequency vibrated my entire body. Suddenly, I began questioning how I had gotten to this point and what I was doing there. Like a kid riding a roller coaster, listening to the gears clank, climbing the rail, preparing to make our first plunge, suddenly wanting off the ride with no exit in sight. I began to rock back and forth, trying to avoid looking inward and wishing I could escape the experience, when the first vision suddenly came. With my eyes closed, I saw, as if projected onto the inside of my forehead, rapid, flashing images, a machine gun fire of pictures, a cacophonous barrage of screens, TV screens, phone screens, computer screens, movie screens, literal POV images from my entire life, from childhood to present day, all the floating monitors I had spent the majority of my waking life staring at, entranced by, enslaved to. As if the medicine was defragging my brain of all of these images, or teaching me how I had been spending my life, I understood that I was not really living life, rather that my life was living me. The next vision I was shown was even more unsettling. It was of my little sister, Shai, who was 19 at the time, attending school for fashion at FIT in Manhattan. The vision was crystal clear, and it was of Shai walking down a dark New York City street, scared and alone, shivering in the snow. As I watched this dreary vision unfold, struggling to decipher what it all meant, I began to hear multiple voices surrounding me, casually talking about me as if a doctor would talk to a nurse in a hospital. It was strange, but I wrote it off as if I was just hallucinating. But then the next thing I knew, I felt those disembodied voices physically touching me. Although the touching was gentle enough, it was so real that it scared me and caused me to panic in fear. That is when the strange turned stranger, as these disembodied voices I was hearing suddenly responded, surprised by the fact that I could hear them, in which they then turned their attention immediately to consoling me, saying that it was okay and not to be afraid, and that they were just there to help me, adding that I had done this before and everything was going to be all right. Well, despite their kind words of affirmation, their very real, equanimous, measured reaction to my fearful reaction only terrified me more, as I was suddenly hit with the staunch realization that this was no hallucination, and what I was led to believe about psychedelics from TV and movies was not even scratching the surface of what these experiences actually are. Even though the shamans warned us that they were going to call Dr. Sitos, which are benevolent spirit doctors, to help us heal, I was not prepared for the reality of that experience. And as soon as I met them, my fight or flight response triggered, and I began to do everything I could to break out of that experience. I kicked and screamed, resisting the medicine the rest of the journey, which is the single worst thing I could have possibly done. But at that point, I was inconsolable. For what felt like an eternity, I spent the entire night in the jungle, crying, shaking, sweating, and purging, begging for the experience to end. That was one of the longest, most brutal nights of my entire life. And afterward, I didn't think I would ever work with psychedelic medicines ever again. But when I called my sister the next day to tell her the vision I was shown and ask if she was okay, my sister broke down crying and told me that she was assaulted by her best friend a month prior and that she hadn't told anyone yet and was not doing well. I consoled my sister and convinced her to tell my parents what had happened, in which she did, and luckily, they were able to get her help before it was too late. That phone call bonded me and my sister for life, and proved to me that despite the grueling nature of the ayahuasca experience, there was too much truth, healing, and wisdom to this medicine for me to not continue to explore it. The next night, I stepped back into the fire and continued to go as deep as I could in the medicine before fear crept back in and my suffering would repeat all over again. Until one night, a year later, things finally shifted. I was in a ceremony in Costa Rica that my mother had dragged me to try and help me get over my fears. This specific ceremony was the second night in a row of a weekend ayahuasca retreat. And what I did not know at the time was the reason behind this shift in my experience. And before I share what happened to me, I want my mother to explain what happened in her ceremony to help better illuminate the power of this medicine, the power of humankind, and the power of a mother's love.
I have complete unconditional love for and would do anything for. You know, die for them, you live for them. Everything you do is for them because they are really the only things that matter to me in this world. So after my experience in Spirit Quest, it was very clear to me that Cody's experience that he had in Spirit Quest, his fear that he was dealing with and that he was faced with, that he needed to go back and clear this energy. It was very clear that Mother Ayahuasca has nothing but pure love in her heart, and it was nothing to fear. And I knew I had to take Cody back to the medicine, and we were going to clear this fear so he could move forward. And that was kind of difficult because Cody was so traumatized that he didn't even want to talk about ayahuasca again. And yet I came back with this respect for this medicine that, or I call it a spirit, that I never knew I could have this kind of respect or love for a plant medicine. So I came back and I kept trying to get Cody to go back to Peru, and there was no way that was happening. And one day Cody came to me, and Cody was telling me about a shaman that he became friends with who was holding ceremonies in Costa Rica. I said to Cody, would you go with me? And Cody said, yes. We're on our way to Costa Rica, and Cody is freaking out. He is sweating. He is jumpy. And I'm trying to talk him down, you know, and I'm trying to tell him, Cody, it's going to be great. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to be there with you. I knew with me being there that Cody would feel some comfort in that. But as we're getting closer, we land in Costa Rica, he is like freaking out even more. And now comes to the ceremony. And I go up, and how ceremonies work is it's like in a big circle, and people go one at a time. They go up to the altar and they set their intentions, and then they go sit down and they wait for everybody else to set their intentions and drink, you know, the ayahuasca. And I go down, I sit down, and my intention was that Cody was able to relieve his fear. And all of a sudden, my brain is starting to freak out. I'm starting to panic. I'm going, this is going to be a bad ceremony. Bad stuff is going to happen. Got to get out of this. Don't do this. This is bad. It's not going to go well. And I'm freaking out. And I that's not my personality. Don't freak out. I'm not afraid of many things. I'm not afraid of death. I skydive. I scuba dive. I ski. I'm not that kind of girl. And I'm panicking. And my brain is going, go to the bathroom, throw this up. This is not a good idea. This is going to be bad. It's going to get really bad, really ugly. And I go into the bathroom and I'm shoving my fingers down my throat and I'm trying to throw up the medicine. And I can't. And I go and I sit down and my brain is just racing. All these ugly, like, dark thoughts are running through my brain. And now the medicine is starting to kick in. And for me, when the medicine starts to kick in, it gets really dark. And I start seeing eyes all around the room, glowing eyes. And my mind is freaking. It's like, oh my God, there's aliens in here. This is bad. It's going to get really ugly. It's bad. It's bad. And I'm putting my hands up going, Mother Ayahuasca, I changed my mind. I don't want to do this. And all of a sudden, I said, wait a minute. I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid of aliens. And now I'm feeling like I'm insulting the medicine, and I start apologizing to her, and I'm like, I'm so sorry. I don't know where this is coming from. I am so, so sorry. And she says, it's coming from Cody. I'm going to cry. And I said, what? She goes, you're here for Cody, right? And I said, yes. And she said, are you willing to take his pain and his suffering? And I said, in a second. And I got it. And I got it on so many levels. And in that second, I woke up out of the medicine. And I've been walking around with Cody's fear ever since. But, you know, when you do things like this, you're not really actually sure if you're imagining these things or if it's real. And I had to wait till half of the ceremony through to find out what Cody's ceremony was like, because I wasn't sure if I created it in my own head, because I wanted Cody's fear to go away so bad that I manifested it. So now, meanwhile, I'm not on the medicine at all, and I'm just sitting there waiting and praying that I took Cody's fear from him. And it came to the sharing stick. When Cody got the sharing stick, Cody started crying. Sorry, it was a big moment for me. And he said it was the best ceremony. It was the first time he did a ceremony without any fear. And I cried, because it's every mother's dream that your child does not walk through life with fear.
Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome, baby.
I love you.
Love you too.
Unaware of what my mother had done for me, this ceremony was indeed the ceremony I was finally able to release my fears and fully surrender to the medicine. And this was the night I received the teaching I had needed to hear all along. My ayahuasca experience started for me as it usually does, with a physiological temperature change, followed by a discomfort in my stomach. I usually begin to see visions gradually emerge from the darkness, complex spirals of light that are colorful, vibrant, electric, and fractal in nature. If I remain still and do not react to the discomfort, these lights gradually intensify in vividness, moving to the music in the room, until they slowly wrap beyond my vision and encase my entire body in a cocoon of light. I am then absorbed into what I can only describe as a portal. This is the point where I feel as if I am dying, as my consciousness begins to vibrate and expand beyond my body. This is the part I would normally give into fear and resist the feeling of dying, as to try and control the experience from happening. But this time, for the first time, I had no fear, and I was able to let go and allow the medicine to work on me without resistance. Not knowing what my mother had done for me, I was able to surrender long enough for the process to take hold. As I experienced what I could only describe as an astral projection through this strange, beautiful, and ever-unfolding dimension of pure consciousness. When I came out the other side, I was in a black void of pure darkness and complete silence. I looked around, and I saw nothing. But when I turned my head upward, I found, hovering above me, a massive, glowing, golden, flowing, multidimensional creature that I have never seen anything like in all of my life. It was staring down at me and was obviously sacred, highly intelligent, and some sort of ancient deity or cosmic entity or something. I wish I had better words to describe it, but the closest thing I can compare it to was one of those golden dragons found in ancient Chinese cultures, with a boxy face, big eyes, a large mouth, a serpent's body. But it was so much more complex than that. Its hair wasn't even hair, it was swirls of energy that didn't end but rather extended and morphed back into whatever dimension it was emanating from. This figure was so real and intimidating that I immediately looked away from it, turning my gaze downward. That is when this being spoke. It said,
"Why do you look away from me?"
In which I replied, "I don't know. I'm ashamed." In which this creature replied,
"Why are you ashamed?"
In which I began to panic, the fear creeping back in. I replied, I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. The next thing I knew, at the snap of a finger, I was teleported into another world, an idyllic, Eden-like land with green, rolling hills and blue skies, as I was suddenly sitting under a lone tree on top of a hill in pure tranquility. With this very familiar feeling, as if I had been to this place before. As I looked around at this beautiful, serene landscape, I heard the voice of that ancient being telepathically speak into my mind, saying,
"You are ashamed because you put your work before your family. And until you learn this lesson, you will return again and again and again."
And the next thing I knew, I was back in my body. I opened my eyes to find my hands magnetically pinned together in prayer position, with my mother looking at me from across the room with tears in her eyes, in which the truth of what I was told finally sank in. My mother, a perfect mirror of devotion and sacrifice, sitting in front of me, showing me the way with her patient strength and loving example. Suddenly, realizing the error of my ways, I hung my head and I wept. That ceremony, I learned the true source of my suffering, and I took a vow to never put my work before my family ever again. There is no such thing as priorities. The word priorities is an oxymoron. There can only be one singular priority. And I will spend the rest of my life practicing the art of making my family that priority, as well as healing the wounds I created in myself and my family by not putting my family first above all else for so long. We live in such a work-obsessed culture that rewards those who succeed in their vocation, that we have incentivized generation after generation to push our relationships with our family to the back burner. As we work to advance our careers and make more money, ironically, doing so to make proud the very people we alienate in the process. When the truth is, the only thing real in this world is each other. And what matters most is our relationships with ourselves, with our family, our community, the earth, the cosmos, and all sentient life. And when we connect harmoniously with all these things, the many will become the one, and the one will finally be healthy, healed, and whole again. No matter the illness, no matter the symptom, no matter the pain, when we look to heal our relationships, starting with those closest to us, we will in turn heal ourself and by proxy, heal the whole.
So the key point is that these are not party drugs. They're incredibly powerful substances that should be treated with respect.
I experience the complete dissolution of my ego.
When the ego dissolves, your sensations and feelings don't cease. Your attachment to your identity does.
We're administering an experience that actually changes you and cures you.
Another universal experience of ayahuasca is the encounter with seemingly intelligent entities.
Remember that I actually is a teacher.
On today's episode, we have a wildly successful entrepreneur and an awakened man of the modern kind, the powerful Panacha Machaya. Panacha has over 20 years of global experience as a successful serial entrepreneur and business leader within numerous Fortune 100 companies, and is currently the CEO of the incomparable Chopra Foundation, working on his newest project, the Metaverse for Good, with his partner, Dr. Deepak Chopra. Panacha is here to share with us his experience working with psychedelic medicines and to teach us a little bit about how to heal ourselves to better show up for our families and for the world.
The Awakened Underground Podcast.
I'm so pumped to have you on to have a conversation with you. Like, thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Cody. I think I'm very grateful to you. You know, I think thank you for sharing the space and this conversation, and I'm looking forward to the journey.
Yeah, absolutely, brother. So I would love, we have so much to cover, so much to talk about. I could ask you a million and one things, but I would love to start. Can you give us a little bit of your story, sort of at 10,000 feet, and take us through your story as a man, your healing journey? And I would love for you to culminate your story with your work with psychedelic medicines or any work you have done with psychedelic medicines.
You know, I came from India, as a software engineer, and I did what I would say I followed the trajectory of following businesses, a Fortune 100 company, executive, you know, Nortel, Motorola, did that. And I think that was the path I followed, I think, which is really what does success mean, right?
Right.
Is become an executive in a Fortune 100 company, that is success, right? And along that journey, I realized that I wasn't asking the right question. You know, who am I? And that really became a theme in my life because, you know, I really was trying to be somebody, who is Panacha Machaya, really? And I think I was reading a book by Krishnamurti, you know, and that really triggered my thought process, you know. And he says, truth is a pathless land. And when in that particular book, he says, comparison and conformity lead to conflict. A mind without conflict is a spiritual mind. And that really struck a chord in me. It said, so comparison and conformity, that's beautiful because what we do every day, either we compare or we conform. And inherently it creates a conflict of
right.
Who we are.
Right.
And that really, I started getting into this journey about who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Because if you look at a child who's running around, they're very happy, right? They're running around with our clothes. They don't know male, female, African-American, Indian, doesn't matter. And all of a sudden you say, Panacha, you're male, you're Indian, and you're Panacha from the community Coorg. And then for the rest of your life, you're screwed because you're defending this fictional character of Punacha Machaya, Indian, so-and-so. So that was my first trajectory. And I said, okay, you know what, who am I? Then I really got on this journey of not really following this path of just executive companies to really seeing like, okay, I had this talent of being a technologist. Can I use that talent to do good? Went to India in 2007, 2008, and I really wanted to celebrate failure, right? I always saw that people in India, especially the hired people who got 99 percentile. When I went to India in 2008, there was also, people didn't realize there was a high suicide rate in Bangalore, the city I grew up in. So I started a company called Above. And Above stand for a bunch of versatile entrepreneurs, right? And I was like, and my whole thing was that you have to know how to fail. And I wanted to hire people who I called had all PhDs. PhD stands for passion, hunger, and drive. If you have the passion to follow whatever you're doing, and if you have passion, then you're willing to go hungry on those days, and your drive will get you there. And that started my second trajectory to look at, you know, we're seeing all this growth in India. I see the cities, but there's a huge mental health crisis. But we are the land of yoga.
Is it comparable to the mental health crisis in the States?
You know, I would say it's worse in one way because there's also a huge stigma. We don't talk about it.
Oh, wow.
Right? We are like grown men don't cry. And so that is the second trajectory. And along that journey, I met Deepak, right? And that's the journey when me and Deepak kind of really started, and as a dear friend, mentor, I mean, all of the things we can talk about a true friendship. And with me, I think we kind of looked at the world and said, what do we want? And here's the mantra, we said, I want to reach 1 billion people for a joyful, energetic body, a loving, compassionate heart, a reflective and alert mind, and lightness of being.
Love that.
Basically boil it down, a more peaceful, just, sustainable, healthier, joyful world, right? And that started my third trajectory, which is looking at Deepak and saying, you know, what do we do? How do we bring well-being in the world? How do I use technology for good? How do I use communities? And that's when I started looking at being an engineer. I started looking at the data and the metrics out there, what's happening. You know, every 40 seconds, we lose someone to suicide globally.
Wild.
And this was before the pandemic.
Right.
Right?
Right. That accelerated everything.
And we don't even know what it looks like right now.
Yeah,
we do
I can't find any numbers around.
We don't know, right? But we do know there's a teen mental health crisis, which is if the second leading cause of death among young adults in this country is by suicide, what are youth are saying, okay, great, guys, you're building all this amazing technology, you're looking at the Mars, you're taking, you know, building the amazing electric cars and all of that, but we don't want to be here. We actually want to exit this universe. That's what our youth are saying. That really got me thinking about just about me and my purpose. And I had one of those moments 4 years ago where I really went and said, you know, what does this all really mean? Yeah. And so coming from a culture of really like grown men don't cry, right? And then having this almost like this mask, you have to have all the answers. And we always talk about consciousness, Deepak and me talk about it, that everything we see here is just one of the best virtual reality experiences.
Seriously. Right? Like, so literally, yeah.
And we kind of take ourselves so seriously. Now, is there a way for us to be more self-aware? And I realized my ego was always getting in the way. And I had to kind of drop those things which I was, you know, conditioned to. I had to drop my comparison, drop this conformity to really live a life without conflict. And that took me to my whole journey of, can we explore other alternatives? And plant medicine was one of those journeys I took. Because I was also at a very point in my life where I was like, what is the point? Like, you know, end of the day, we're all going to die.
Would you identify with, at that point, having an existential crisis of sorts? Or were you experiencing any symptoms of depression? Or was it just the allure of the past life you were living sort of fading a little bit?
I think sometimes when I look at, when you get to know a lot, right? When you realize that with all this information, and you get a certain sense of awareness that, for me, it was more like, what is happening in this world?
Right.
There's so much of death, destruction. We are like the only species which are basically going to eradicate everything else. What is the world we are bringing our children into? You know, what is the meaning of all of this? Like, why, if we are doomed, then why bother?
Right.
Right. So I was kind of having this moment of, it's really bleak. What's the point? Right. And so I really had to kind of go deep down to find the answers.
Hey, gang. We'll be back with more after this quick break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now back to our regular scheduled deprogramming.
What practices did you start to explore, even outside of psychedelic medicines, to create? Because not everyone listening to this story, listening to this show, might be quite ready for that. What were the modalities you started to tap in? Let's say meditation or breath work, or what would you reach for? What's in the toolkit?
So I think for me, in the toolkit, the two things, one was meditation.
Nice.
Right. So really, for me, self reflection. Who am I? Four soul questions. Who am I? What do I want? What is my purpose? And what am I grateful for? Every day going through this process of asking myself, who am I? Who am I? When I ask myself the question of who am I, and that is really interesting because am I Punacha at 52? Who's the Punacha who was 5 years old? You know, is that just a dream? So we are this kind of ever-changing. And that meditation practice of self-inquiry really helped me a lot.
That self-inquiry meditation practice is one of the most profound ancient teachings. You're saying it very casually, but that is extremely profound. And I would just add to that I think for everyone listening, it's easier said than done, but all it takes is creating the space every day. Maybe it's your first hour to do that for any of these practices. So you can have the space, you're going to show up, you're going to sit there, and you can move into this exercise of inquiry or meditation or so on and so forth. But please keep going, because that's incredibly profound.
Yeah, and that's the four soul questions, asking myself every day without trying to force an answer, but just observing how I felt.
How did it evolve the question, who am I?
And then it's constant. Every day I ask myself the same question. And it's evolving every day, right?
What can you show us what that answer, that evolution of answers look like? I know it's a little personal.
So when I look at it right now, I think one thing is certain is that we are a fictional identity.
100%.
And really, our goal in life is play.
Yep.
Right? Maya and Leela, right?
Yep.
So what is the one thing I learned from my practices? Stop taking yourself too seriously.
Right? You mean lighten up?
Right, lighten up. And two, stop being right. You know, we want to be right. And being right means somebody else is wrong.
100%.
That doesn't mean don't stand up for what's just, but stop trying to prove that you're right.
And there is a paradox at play. The opposite of every truth is equally as true. This dualist illusion, if you want to pick a side and identify with it, it's just going to isolate and separate you from the collective. And this is about unity and transcending duality and transcending identity as part of that.
Absolutely. Second toolkit, which has become an anchor for me, is breath, right? And I always use breath as an anchor because when you're hyperventilating, we've actually forgotten how to breathe as a civilization. You know, when we have very short breaths, we don't ground ourselves, right? And I think when we don't breathe, we actually are always in what I call sympathetic overdrive. So we're constantly in stress mode, you know? So today the whole world is stressed out. So what I've learned is to incorporate breath to really force myself to be more grounded, to be more present. Like right now, what's the most important thing? Me speaking to you right now, being present. So what I've also learned, and this is people have forgotten the art of being present. People are having dinner, texting on the phone. People are having a meeting, thinking of the next meeting. People are having a conversation, mentally checked out. But I think for us to be present in this dialogue and drop in is the most important thing.
Right. Couldn't agree more. And I do really believe we have less of an ignorance problem now, and it's an attention problem. And when we're not breathing, our, we're reducing blood flow to our brain, which right. is the, we're causing inflammation, which the cause of something, let's say like ADHD in the West is a lack of blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, or at least that's the Western understanding of it. So something as simple as reconnecting with the breath and healing that can mitigate many of the side effects for a condition like ADHD. So I couldn't agree with you more.
And I think as a father, I don't think I was present when my kids were growing up. I was really distracted. And I always thought, oh, they're really young. Will they really notice? They do, right? There is this non-local communication. And I sometimes may think just because you could be physically present but mentally absent. I think I was so busy being an executive. I was so busy trying to be somebody else that I wasn't there for them, right? And I can actually feel it today. They're 21 and they're 17. They're amazingly beautiful boys. But I regret that I wasn't present. And I think there's one thing which the practices of the medicine and my own practices of self-awareness have made me be more present, right? So even if I'm there for 30 minutes, Punacha, be present, right? Then trying to be 30 minutes. And I think the world today has a presence problem.
Right.
Right? And people are trying to do too many things and they're trying to be, and all technology hasn't helped. Right.
Well, you're also, it's very fascinating for you to say that because we look at depression and anxiety and what that, you know, on a physiological level looks like in the West. But from an Eastern perspective, it's very simple and it really does come down to presence. If your mind is in the past, it's depression.
Right.
If your mind is in the future, it's anxiety. If your mind is the present moment, neither can exist. That's why we call the present, which is that right. famous platitude.
Right.
Right. So I could not agree with you more. And you really are hitting on the foundational principles. And even before even going to your medicine experiences, right. you're hitting on the teachings of the medicine.
Right.
I traveled the world working with psychedelic medicines to heal myself. And when I really broke through, what was the lesson? And I was very into human optimization.
Right.
How do I be the best worker? How to be the most successful? How do I heal myself? Right. And what was the message? What was the message behind the wound? What was the teaching? It was I was putting my work before my family.
Right.
You know, it's all about relationships with ourselves, with each other, with our family, especially those very close branches on the tree that we're connected to. You know, they are us as well. Their health and happiness and our connection to them manifests in a lot of mental health issues. So it's not just healing the self. It's also these relationships and showing up for each other. So I love that you're touching on this.
Yeah, I think if we can actually, you know what, be more self-aware, connect with the body mind through breath being the anchor, right? And then have presence. I think we're off to a great start. And I feel today we are super connected, but very lonely, right? I believe that we have all the technology. I always joke that the world doesn't need Tinder, it needs Tender, right? We need tenderness. Where are the virtues of tenderness, right?
Right.
And I think we need to kind of create this conversation, this community. This is why I love what you do. It is truly community. If there's one thing we can do to save the world, let us create authentic conversation. And communication and connection and community, because the Sangha is what the world needs.
Right. Right.
And that's really, so I think we have to go back to some of the principles of intimacy, of really having, the one thing the pandemic has taught us, hopefully, and hopefully we learn from it, is that human beings are optional, right? The world is going to thrive without us. You know, the plant and the flora and the fauna, we were actually coming in the way. Now that we have a second chance, what do we do? Right? Our youth are struggling, right? And I'm very honest. I mean, my own son, you know, who I adore, is having his own challenges. And not because of anything else, it's because they're trying to understand the world they're growing up in.
Right.
Right? The schools have gone online, you know, imagine kids going to school and not being able to meet their friends for a year, you know, graduating without having a graduation, right? So these are extreme times in human history. So we have to come together to see how we can connect with ourselves. So that's my, you know.
I love also bringing it back to connection. Because if I really, out of all, everything I've learned in my life up to this point, it's all, if I had to break into a binary for all illness, it's connection and disconnect. It's connection is, you know, I say this a lot on the show, but if the river is flowing, no disease can form. As soon as it's blocked, disconnected from the rest of the water, and it stagnates, disease forms. So keeping that flow of energy, keeping that connection. And it's interesting because we as a as a people have evolved to continually unconsciously create these technological advantages that have unconsciously disconnected us. And an example would be the shoe, right? We know the earth has an electromagnetic field. We are electromagnetic beings, and walking on the earth keeps you connected to the earth. You put a rubber sole on your shoe and it disconnects you, you know, something like that. Go from a impersonal connection to a cell phone or a text message or social media, and just continue to put these layers of disconnect. And we see, you know, breakthroughs in medicine and science and technology, but the mental, but our sickness is waning, and it starts to be like, well, this doesn't make sense. This is not how this should be going down. And I really truly believe it's just the further disconnect. It's like you said, we're alone together now with social media.
And the fourth toolkit, I think, would be resilience. That I think we need to build the muscle of resilience, right? I think when I look at resilience, you know, we have to embrace impermanence. You know, life happens, right? And how do we provide toolkits for resilience? And I use the example, I call it the ABC principle, right? When you're going through the deepest, darkest winter of your life, A is, what is your attitude, right? You have an attitude of gratitude. Is a glass half empty or half full? It's very important to have this attitude, right? And that gives you a different lens over what you're going through. B is, what is your belief system, right? Do you believe in impermanence? Even though today is the deepest, darkest winter, like I said, there's going to be, you know, the sun sets, the sun's going to rise, right? There's going to be winter, there's going to be summer, right? So do you believe in impermanence? And if you believe in impermanence, that means this too shall pass. And C is, what conscious choice are you going to make? Is what you're going to do next going to help you or hurt you? Help others or hurt others? And I think if we can practice this ABC principle in everything we do, right, then life becomes a lot more joyful. You realize that it's like, sometimes what I feel, what we are, and this is one of the revelations when I had through my own journey, is that life is supposed to be like a heartbeat. Life is supposed to be irregular. That is the beauty, right? If it was just sunlight all the time, it's not beautiful. If it's darkness all the time. So you need the peaks, ups and downs, right?
Right. And look around. I mean, you know, metaphors exist for a reason. Metaphors, we use something known to explain the unknown, which implies by its very nature of existence that there is something unknown. And if you look at sort of the mirror of our reality, like you said, night and light, right? Good and bad. You know, if there's a choice, if both exist, then what do you choose to believe? You can choose to support both of them. There's a choice. There's a paradox at play. So we have a choice to choose our beliefs, to choose our attitude, to choose our actions. And that's really where the medicine and the healing comes. I do feel we first have to wake up to that we do have cultural programming we are unconscious to. Mm-hmm. So just becoming conscious of our unconsciousness, and then we can start to move into conscious consciousness, where we're doing the right thing, but we have to force it, like in a gratitude exercise.
Right.
And then eventually, once we habituate it and we create these neural pathways, then we're moving into unconscious consciousness, where you don't even have to think about it. You are doing the right thing. You're eating the right way. You're having the right practice. You have healthy relationships with your family, healthy relationships with yourself. So I love everything you're saying.
And I think Rumi says, God's language is silence. Everything else is poor translation, right? And I think there's so much of magic in that one sentence, because we don't understand and appreciate solitude, right? Magic is in the silence. There's magic in that, right? But sometimes we're always so driven by stimulus. So even, I think, embracing silence and stillness as a virtue versus always being in overdrive of stimulus. And I would love to see a class growing up where children are taught to embrace stillness. Because only in stillness, there is presence.
Truth.
Right?
Truth. I would love to see that. I would love to see, I love in South America, they have some meditation and ayahuasca being worked into their prison systems. We have David Lynch Foundation, the TM, have been working on bringing meditation into school systems, and the numbers are amazing. You see the grades improve, you see there's less detention, you see more harmony. So it'd be amazing to bring silence as a practice into the classroom and as a culture, as something that's kind of part of our major food groups. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, there's not just sleep and eat and work and play, you know, also a time for it to practice stillness and to just being, you know, so we can better show up in all those other areas in our life.
100%.
I would love to have you take us too, because you just hit a little bit about the lesson you learned on your journey. Can you take us to, now that you've given us a little bit about your teachings and what you've learned, take us to your work with psychedelic medicines, and what does that journey look like for you? What medicine did you work with? How did you get to it? Please, I'd love to hear that part of your story.
Yeah, I think when I first got into it, you know, a friend of mine said, hey, you know what, Punachi, you're always looking at solutions for mental health. Have you? And I looked at the studies with ayahuasca, I think the prison system in Brazil. And I had looked at it on trauma. And so I'm the kind of person who says, okay, if before I go tell somebody else to do something, I need to know what it is, right? So
yeah, same.
So my first thing was, you know, I was introduced to by a friend of mine, and Cucho was the shaman from Peru. And I remember, actually, I was like, you know, I don't know, this is going to be yet another whatever experience, right? So let me kind of go through this. And what I remember very distinctly going through this experience is, for the first time, dissolution of the ego, right? Because I fight so hard to control my environment, right? And for me, everything is about how do I control outcome? That's kind of my, you know, that's my conditioning, right?
Right, same.
And my first experience taught me this, like, life is like the two ends of a napkin. One end is the time you were born. You have no control. Other end is a time when you're going to leave this universe, or death. You have no idea when that's going. It's certain, but you don't know the mode and the modality and the time. So if you have control over one of them, you have some control on what it is. You don't have control on both. So you have to let go. And so that was the first lesson, and my experience was letting go.
Yeah, same.
And for me, that was a huge step, because I always like to manage my environment. I like to, and then I realized that was inherently what was creating stress for me. Inherently was creating the conflict. Inherently was creating all the things which I didn't need to bring into my world. So I think that was my first journey. And I think the first experience was that insight that everything in this world is a sensation, image, feeling, or thought. That is it. So that's a beautiful experience, because the world is only through sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts. If I close my eyes, I can, you know, shut off one part of my world. But as you start limiting your senses, then the only thing left is pure consciousness, in which everything else evolves. So that was my first insight. And it was amazing, because that kind of started my journey in asking questions. Who am I?
Right, right. I had the same experience, and I had the same programming. You know, right. I'm a director, so right. It's like control. And it's interesting, as an artist, so there's two types of artists. You can be result, or I say two types of directors. You can be result-oriented or process-oriented. You know, I always found it fascinating when I would study the directors I love, the American directors. They had a vision, and you're always supposed to have a vision, but there was like these French directors, and they would have no idea what they're doing, and they'd show up, and they were process oriented. And I didn't even believe it. I actually thought it was like a cop out for some reason, like, oh, you don't have a vision. You don't know, you know, you're a director. You're the purveyor of tone. You have to have the vision. And going through this process, actually this show has been the most process oriented thing I've ever been a part of. And life is so much more beautiful that way, because it always unfolds in ways you couldn't even imagine. You know, keep going to the medicine and having to, because I still go to the medicine. I still have to have that ego death. I still find myself sort of like clinging sometimes. And it really teaches you that it's a faith-based game, whatever we're in. You know, in the unknown, you know, life is born. In the unknown, that's where creativity comes from. That's where beauty and inspiration comes from. When you know it, it remains fixed. And as we said, when things remain fixed, that's when disease forms.
Right.
And we want to open ourselves to this ever-flowing, ever-changing, transcendent consciousness. You know, you mentioned consciousness before. Right. It's what is consciousness? Right. And when you interface with consciousness, let's say, in a medicine ceremony, it is ever flowing and always changing and infinite and complex and intelligent, you know, and it really is humbling, because when I have that interface, I realize how limited I truly am in my beliefs and what I think I know. And it's almost as every time I think I know something, it keeps me from knowing more. Right. It makes me fixed in place and it keeps me from evolving. And then I have to go back through this death, back through this lesson of unknowing. So I love what you're getting at. Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now. Take me deeper into your ceremony, this death experience, as someone who's a spiritual man, as someone who's had all these practices and then was testing the waters here with some ancient medicine, you know, was it an interface with another consciousness or a spiritual interface, or did it feel more like an internal mind-made interface?
You know, there was definitely, as I keep doing, I've done it a couple of times after that and more than a couple of times, is that it is also a process of discovery, right? So there was definitely internal dialogue, right? For me, it was very evident. I was having this a very profound internal dialogue, right? But there was also what I would say unity consciousness. And I really felt that I always said, you know, we're all connected. Right? And I felt like, okay, we're all breathing the same atoms. The only reason that's Cody and this is Punacha, because I know the visual cortex is saying, you're there, I'm here. And now we are basically, my hands are here, your hands are there. So it's all based on senses. But yet we're all one living, breathing organism, which is completely connected.
Right?
If I was able to vibrate at a certain frequency or see like a snake, then I would not see you. I would see like an infrared spectrum, right?
Yeah.
Or echolocation of a bat, which already says that, okay, if three species are having three different versions of Cody and Punacha, what is real, right? So, you know, if A is not equal to B and B is not equal to C, then A is not equal to C, right?
Right.
That means that as many universes as the species are there, right? Your dog has a different universe. A cat has a different universe. You have a different universe. This is not a microphone to a dog. What is this? We don't know, right? So then we know that this universe is just, I would say, a lie. We both agreed to say this is a microphone.
Right.
Right. This could be anything, right? So that insight was very profound to me. And I felt that. I felt love. I felt that love is the only emotion which will transcend and save us as a species.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That was, if you ask me, Punacha, what came out of the whole thing is that this concept of, and this has also become a program now, love in action.
Right.
Right, which is based on the four tenets. A is attention, deep listening with every cell in your body. The second A is appreciation. Once you have deep attention, appreciate everyone's uniqueness, right? The third A is affection. Kindness, tenderness, compassion. And the last A is acceptance. Accepting everybody for who they are, not what you want them to be. And this became the four love in action, working with Deepak, as a core tenets of how we want to bring love into this world.
I love that you're taking it back to love. Right. And I love to explain why, because it goes back to connection and disconnection. For me, like, love is the word we use to express the emotion of connection. If I say Punacha,
right.
I love you, brother.
Right.
I feel connected to you, is what I'm saying. It's that emotion has been stigmatized and bastardized and ostracized and demonized and become a platitude that's thrown around so much, and people put on a pedestal, oh, to be in love, oh, you can't tell someone you love. So I mean, I have people I love who I tell them I love them all the time, and
right.
I watch them cringe. I see the blockages it provokes to feel that connections, and it really starts to come down to, when it comes to disease and unease and being unwell, is what are the conditions we put on love? What are the conditions we put on connection? And that's not just with another. That's not just with the earth. That's not just with your brother, your parents. It's with yourself.
Yeah.
The deepest work I end up doing so far has been, outside of medicine, has been mirror work. It's been self-love work. I realized.
Is there a process you follow?
You know what? It came through medicine. It was something that happened in a medicine ceremony. So when I get brought to, when there's a healing being done and I'm being walked through something, I will take whatever I was put through in a medicine ceremony and I will try to practice it and use it as a template. Mm-hmm. So I just realized that I had put all these conditions on my own self-love. So it was, if I was not successful, I would not love myself. If I did not make this movie, I would not love myself. If I did not have this, I would not love myself. And I actually very consciously implemented those programs into myself to make sure I succeeded as a young person. Be like, oh, well, you know, I won't have respect for you if you don't do that. I won't love you if you don't do that. So I literally had to sit there in front of a mirror, and it was hard work, especially as a man, you know, to be like, and look at myself and be like, I will love you if you're not successful. I will love you if you don't have money. I will love you if you're X, Y, Z. And a lot of times doing that practice of sitting there, at first it'd feel real, real cheesy. And then next thing you know, I would just start weeping. And it became a great catharsis. And it really did help me sort of get beyond this experience of, help me push through a lot of the, reprogram myself. Because it's reprogramming, to reprogram myself, to love myself without condition. But to take it back to your ceremony, was this ayahuasca you were working
ayahuasca,
with?
Ayahuasca, yeah.
Ooh, you went right to for the jugular.
I'm like, let me just go for it. Let me just like, you know,
yeah,
let me go all in, like, you know.
So, all right. So being from India, right? Soma.
Right.
Soma. Were you like, when you drank this medicine, were you like, oh my God, this is the mythical, Soma.
The first cup wasn't as much. And then I remember him saying, have another one. First time I was more like, you know, I was trying to be macho. Like, oh, I'm good. Whatever.
Me too, bro.
And then the second one, I think, I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, so it was very much, okay, this is submit. The whole thing was submitting. So being vulnerable, right? So for me, it was all about, you know, I got this. Right. I got my breathing technique figured out. I'm going to kind of go through this and I'm going to get out of this and I'm going to prove, like, you know, this is yet another, you know, woo-woo thing. That is what I went in with. I'll admit, like, you know, I'm like, I'm going to control this experience.
I get that though. I've tried so much stuff and I'm always like that. I have a healthy degree of like, you know, it was pretty disarmed. I mean, I've never been disarmed like that.
I think the second thing which I was is that I think I was addicted to life. And I think I would say, you know, I have grown up, you know, during my tech days, you know, people ask me, why don't you drink? You know, we have one or two glasses of wine, not as much. I was like, I was a guy who drank a bottle of scotch and thought everything was fine. Like, no big deal. I got it. I can handle it. Because I grew up in a culture where, you know, from my hometown, where drinking was just like, it's that's what you do.
It's like breathing, right?
That's what you do. And by the way, you are designed to be a very good, you can consume any amount of alcohol and you'll be fine because that's a community you come from and that's how you're designed, right? And I had to put my hand on my heart and say, you know what? No, that's completely, if I believe the worst, people talk about medicine, psychedelic medicine and this and that. If the people have to regulate one drug, which is the worst drug in the world, is alcohol.
100%.
Right? And so anybody wants really bad, and it's not going to happen because it's the biggest lobby in the world. Right?
The alcohol lobby?
Alcohol lobby, like, and it's never going to get stopped.
Are they really the biggest lobby in the world?
I don't know, but I would assume. Like, I assume they are. Like, you know.
I'm like, I don't know.
But right. I'm like, that should be a controlled substance.
100%.
Because, you know, you can go buy a keg of beer in, you know, in a grocery store and be completely fine.
I don't drink alcohol. Right. I was raised in a straight edge family.
Right.
I don't drink. I'm at a wedding. I need to socialize or, you know, in solidarity, I will have sometimes. Actually, because the most challenging thing about not drinking is the social taboo of not drinking.
Absolutely.
It kills the vibe. We all get together. Everyone's like, I'm not drinking. I kill the vibe of the room. Everyone's like, so that's why I've become accustomed to, I will drink. Okay. I'll have a little wine. I'll sip on it, but I'm totally with you. And I'm sorry for anyone if this is like triggering to hear this. But obviously it's not healthy for you.
Right.
You know, there was that wave, I don't know, a decade ago, it's the resveratrol and the wine. There's plenty of things that are good for your heart. You don't need
and
the wine.
And that was the second insight. So when I had the ego dissolution, the oneness, the love, I actually, for the first time, my addiction or my need to have alcohol to be, you know, I almost, it was just like a fun thing to do. There was no side effects, but it wasn't good for my body. But I was able to kind of literally throttle it down, right? Where now I can have a 2 glass of wine and just be happy.
Right, which right? I feel like is true control, you know, when you don't have to go to, if you have to go like, look, abstinence is great. You do whatever you need. But if you can tap into something a little bit and have that moderation, that balance, that's true control over a substance. So it's not controlling you.
Right. So that was a very interesting byproduct.
Right.
Right.
Which that's amazing. I didn't know you, it made you clean up your
It was. I would say, and I think it's kind of, and as I've gone through the journey, I think it's getting a lot more clarity in some of these things. So for me, when I do any of these things, it's more about, I go in with an intention, which is very important. You do any of these things, setting the intention. Why are you doing it? What is the outcome? It's almost like you put the intention and the universe conspires to find the answer for you, right? So that's always been my reason when I've done any of these things.
I say this a lot, but anything in life can be a medicine or a poison. It's about intention, dosage, and quality. And the power of intention, if you've not weaponized this construct or brought it into your life, it can be hard to understand. But it's almost as if we are in a free will school, and it is the key to unlocking whatever it is you want. I always reference the reticular activation system, right? Which is a system in your brain which limits information, right? Limits it. So if you're walking down the street, you're not hearing the conversations, but if someone says your name, you'll hear it. If you say a word I don't know, I go, what does that word mean? You know, next thing I know, I hear it 3 times that week. I've never heard that word in my life. I heard it once, asked you what it meant. Now I'm hearing it everywhere. It's almost like once you need to consciously open yourself to that, direct your consciousness towards that space, and it will open that channel of information and vitality into your life. So I love that you're talking about intention, because it's so important with anything. Even if you have a cup of coffee, heck, if you do drink alcohol, do it with intention. Anything you do with intention.
Right. I think those are some of the things which I think I would go back. And I think the more and more I think about it, it taught me presence, right? It's like sometimes you walk into a room, you meet a teacher, you meet somebody. They said, man, I felt good. I felt a shift. At the end of the day, we're all energy beings, right? And I think when you're present, you actually can set the stage and the conversation and the space. You can hold space,
right?
To hold space, you need to have presence.
I love that. And we use the term a lot here, holding space. And it's not really a term people outside of the medicine or psychedelic community understand. But truly, holding space is being in that present frequency.
Right.
If I'm, let's say, holding space and I'm not serving, let's say I'm a guardian for a circle. And let's say I'm not working with the medicine. Usually if I'm guarding, I'm working with a little bit of medicine. But sitting, being present, and holding that frequency of presence, which really is sort of the Wi-Fi password to tuning into this universal frequency that then will emanate out from you and help ground the circle, ground the space, ground the room. You want to show up for your family? Be present, you know, hold that space and bring that frequency to the room, and that will anchor everyone and unite everyone. It's truly a gift that's a little understood in the West. So I would love to talk a little bit more about you worked with psychedelics, you worked with ayahuasca a few times after that.
Right.
Did it change for you throughout the experience? Did it go that first time, did it deepen? Because I'm finding that there are layers to this work. There are levels to this work. It's like in any art form, there's a depth. It's not just, oh, I'm a musician, I pick up a guitar, I'm a musician. No, there's a skill set, and you learn different techniques, and you can play different songs and different types of instruments. Did you find a deepening to the work?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think because when I became more intentional, I became more purposeful. I really wanted to understand at the core of my being, who am I, right? So I think it helped me navigate through my own, it helped me navigate consciousness. It helped me navigate, you know, this whole plethora of things we have up against us. Helped me navigate life, right? So but I also use that to go, so example, I work with a very well-known psychotherapist, right, who Geeta Ved, who works with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I've done a lot of work with her. So I've actually taken the learnings and kind of also moved into multiple areas.
So you've done ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Yeah. What did you think of ketamine? And how did it compare to the sacred plant you worked with?
I know two things. One is I also come back and say practitioner. Right. Who is the shaman? Who is the guide? I like working with Gita a lot because it's 30 minutes, right? I go in, I can work on something, get out. So I think there is a lot of benefits. And especially when you are working in today's world, in the world we live in today with regulations, ketamine gives you, I would say, a doorway, and especially the right psychotherapist. So one of the things we have done is working with Deepak and Gita, and you know, and also working with academic institutions like Mount Sinai, to really go back and say, can we do a psychotherapy, assisted psychotherapy with meditation and breath work as leading into the session, and after the session, give them the tools, right, to recreate it. So I think for us, absolutely, love it. And I think it has helped me greatly. You know, when I was going through my own trauma, I think it was something which I've used actively.
Wow.
Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now.
Now, being someone that's in the consciousness space, the mental health space, you have an initiative called Never Alone to help with suicide prevention. Working with these modalities that are being legalized and decriminalized, do you see a path to these modalities being integrated to help with the mental health crisis?
You know, like I said, if every 40 seconds we are faced with a loss of a precious life, we know what we're doing right now with traditional medicine is not working, right? It's not going to be as effective. And that's when I looked at things like technology. Right. Can I use AI chatbots to be an intervention? And we did this particular AI chatbot over the pandemic. We had more than 6 million messages exchanged on the platform, wow. 4,800 suicide interventions on an AI chatbot.
Whoa. Right?
So we know how serious this issue is. But as a foundation, we've been looking at this whole area of psychedelic medicine and research and public awareness. So we are working with a company called Cybin out of Canada to look at psilocybin. How do we kind of look at that as a molecule? And over the next 5 years or 10, over the next decade, I think there's going to be ushering this whole area of looking at psychedelic medicine as an intervention. We work closely in alliance with the Beckley Foundation. Amanda Fielding, amazing work they're doing in psilocybin. They've done amazing trials. So we're kind of keeping up with that work. So from our perspective, we want to look at this, and obviously with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, there's obviously looking at ibogaine, as you know, as far as addiction goes for the opioid crisis. I know the veteran community is very active in this area too. So our goal is to really bring light and awareness and to provide people a toolkit to navigate through this. This space, and that's why I love what you're doing, we need more people shining the light and educating, right? And also, I think, destigmatizing this conversation. And I think that's a huge need of the hour.
The biggest thing that's going to destigmatize this is people like yourself who are successful and, you know, rational, intelligent people and who have also a mindfulness and spiritual practice and care about your health. And you can right. say, hey, I worked with this. This was not detrimental. This was a high vibrational, you know, tool. And there is an application in society. I mean, that's going to open the door.
And also with the community. And that's why I think, you know, when you create a community and a tribe, you know, we go to the Olympics. There are probably 10 coaches you have. If you're an Olympic athlete, you probably have 10, a mental coach, a nutrition coach, and probably 5 different coaches. How come in the Olympics of life, you have no coaches? Right? Life is like going to the Olympics, right? You need to find your tribe. You need to find your life coach, your nutritional coach, your movement coach, your fun coach, right? Why don't we give our youth an Olympic training program for life?
Do you feel like, is this something you're working on to try to find an avenue or a space where you can start to open a doorway where people can have that training?
I am. I'm learning through my own life. You know, I'm talking to my son who's 17 is my teacher, right? I'm trying to like understand through his lens. If you say don't play games, but guess what? They have to be online. So in the pandemic, what could you do? You were stuck at home. And the only way you could connect with your friends, either through League of Legends or through Fortnite. The question for me is that now, can we design a boost which instead of going into a sympathetic overdrive, gets you to breathe, can be tied to an Apple Watch.
Amazing.
Right?
Love that. Are you kidding me? Absolutely. Because repression doesn't work. If right. anything, this if anything, if we look at reality, repression causes trauma.
Right.
And it's why we're in this, you know, this societal crisis that we're in right now. I mean, repression doesn't work, but it's about creating, making every, whatever it is, whether it's sex or food or mind-altering substances, how are we doing it consciously?
Right.
How are we doing it consciously? Is this what you're doing for the metaverse, for goodness?
Yeah.
Are you going to make, please, yeah. oh baby, give it to me. What are you, are you going to make the space conscious? Is that, are you going
to
help?
You know, I look at it, and I came to this country in 1991, and I came to this country, I think one of the things I wanted, a big house, big car, fast thing, all the different things, which we designed the internet for. Number one carrier, I think, of internet traffic is pornography, right?
Oh, wow.
Mobile phones were optimized for video codecs for delivering video content, which was once again porn, right? We created cyberbullying, crime. The Web 2 world, or the traditional internet, created the ills of addiction online. I think with the Web 3 world, we are at a unique point in human history where we can kind of take ownership and create a conscious web, right? Where we reward conscious communities. And that's where me and Deepak are working on. We want to create the metaverse for good. And our initiative is called Seva.love. Seva is selfless service, and love is the only thing which matters. And I talked about love in action, the four attributes. Imagine having a token which basically appreciates in value if you practice the four attributes of love. Attention, deep listening, right? Appreciation, understanding each and everyone's uniqueness. Affection, kindness, tenderness, compassion. Acceptance, accepting everybody who they are, not what you want them to be. And that's really our metaverse for good. And we believe this entire generation growing up, yeah, they're playing Fortnite. Let's work with them, right? Let's have the avatar. Let's work with the Bored Apes. I'm working some interesting projects coming up shortly. But one of the projects I'm looking at with NFT for good, launching on April 22nd on Earth Day, is we're rescuing three bears who are stuck in Mongolia, who are refugees of the climate crisis. We talk about
oh my God.
Climate refugees as humans, but there are climate refugees who are animals who are impacted.
Oh my God.
When the tiger forest, there's a fire, the bears came down and started attacking the local Mongolian communities and the family communities, and they were being shot. And now these three juvenile bears are now being held by the local community. We are looking at NFTs to go rescue the three bears, right? So this is conscious web, right? How do we use metaverse for good?
I love that because it's focusing. It's not, we're so on stop this person and, you know, boost that person. It's how do you, starting to bring a consciousness of transmutation. How do you take the technological advances? How do you take these movements? How do you take these people and just guide them, steer them in the right direction in an upward trajectory. I love that. That's genius.
And that's what we should do together. That's what I love with, you know, our conversation.
Put me is in, that, coach.
Yeah, let's do this. And I think, you know, we need to have more conversation and also provoking questions, you know, and then through the discovery, I think we need to teach people how to ask themselves the question, who am I, right? Not just get conditioned, but who am I? Who am I? And just really going deep into that one question, I think we can make the world a better place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel like that question, who am I, when I've done this exercise, what did you call this before?
The four soul questions.
The four soul questions. Yeah. When I've done it, it's interesting because I found it to be a bridge to consciousness. It goes, next thing I know, it's silent. And there's no thoughts, and I'm not me, and I'm one. I'm everything. I'm nothing. And it really is such a tool for dissolving ego. And when we talk about the disillusionment of ego, it is a health application because our disease is tied to our beliefs and our thoughts and our trauma and our programming, and they're almost stuck in the identity, in the fabric of the identity. So when the ego dissolves, it creates this space and allows all of that trauma and density to move away, to flow away from you, to be released. And that's why when we come back to, let's say, a ceremonial journey or psychedelics, and we talk about the dissolution of ego or a death of the self, that death of the self, yourself is being dies and reborn is reborn every day. When you go to sleep, you're dying, and when you that's what a dream state is. That's what dimethyltryptamine and ayahuasca. It's the chemical you produce when you dream. When you wake up, you are reborn anew every day. It's just the idea that we are the same. It's the name and the principles and the clothes and the, and I like this and this is my partner and these are my friends. It's, if we let that go, it's cleansing. It's healing. So I just do love that principle.
I want to maybe leave you with one thought, and maybe people listening to us, right? And we can go through this exercise, and, you know, wherever they are, if they can just say, you know, let's say we go through the exercise, I am, let me remind you, say, I am. I say Punacha Machaya, first name, last name. And you can say, I am, your first name, last name.
Okay, Cody Blue.
Cody Blue. And when you say, I am, first name, last name, and you bring into your mind's eye everything that's going on right now, the good, the bad, the ugly, whatever you're going through in life at this present moment, I am Punacha Machaya, I am Mary Jane, and bring in that energy into you, right? And all those thoughts, all those feelings into your mind's eye. Now, once you've brought that into whatever, everything's going in your life right now, then say, I am, first name, I am Punacha, I am Cody, in your mind. And now go back into a time when you were like, you know, a young child, the earliest memories, maybe your mom, mother carrying you, your grandparents running around the yard, your earliest memories. I am, first name. I am Cody. I am Punacha. I am John, Mary. Now let go of the first name and just say, I am. I am. Or you can use a mantra, Soham. I am. I am. Then you can let go of the I am and just rest in stillness. Silence. So this practice actually is something which I love, because it actually returns you back into who you are, the source, stillness. We are spiritual beings having a human existence. We were the non-local, which became local. Silence, the vibration, I am. I became I am. Then I got an identity, Punacha. Then I got the conditioning, Punacha Machaya. But who am I? I am is non-local. And that's returning to stillness.
It was so interesting, because when I was doing that, so my full name's Cody Blue Snyder. And I dropped my last name and I go as Cody Blue now. And that started with this show. So I said Cody Blue, and it was the first time someone ever said, say your first and last name in this situation. I said Cody Blue, and he said my last name. And it immediately brought up some trauma. Some, okay, like, where's that? Like, my stomach, I felt like, where's that? Okay, what's that resistance? What's that fear? Why, you know, and I was like, oh, am I doing it wrong? All this questioning, right? And the next thing you know, it just started dropping away. And it really just started simplifying and simplifying. And then whatever that resistance or blockage around my identity, because there's even some sort of programming around even the desire to drop a last name or to go just by your first and middle name, whatever it is. And even that alone, it was just, that was so illuminating for the trauma and the busyness of mind around just a name, not even beyond that.
Assumed identity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's still a dream, because then you go back and you say, go back to your earliest memories of Cody just running around, you know, and you realize that's just a dream. You just remember parts of it. It did happen at some point.
Right.
But did it? And I think, so when you go back into this, you realize that we're all connected.
Absolutely.
And I think we got written back to wholeness.
It does feel like, even when we do the medicine ceremonies, there's a sense of returning home at times. And
oneness, connectedness. The first thing when you feel after an experience, I used to always feel like the wanting to go hug people. Nature was always like very vivid for me. I would be able to see the clouds and the mountains and literally find like the dewdrop falling from the petal. And there was this clarity, right? This clarity, because what happens to us is that we almost have, you know, this, we are wearing glasses where the lens is dirty, right? And we're fogged, and it gives you a sense of clarity. So these practices, I think I always believe that we got to combine the wisdom traditions along with the medicine, and together they can be a very powerful modality to bring healing to the world.
I couldn't agree more. And you are actually on the forefront of, you know, more spiritual people that have come on. And I think you're such a perfect conduit, especially for the earlier episodes, because you are a businessman and you are an entrepreneur and you are master of both worlds. And you are in this world, but not of this world. And, yeah, you know, and for you to share these tools is so useful. And it's also inspiring, you know, for a lot of us, a lot of people that think that these two things of perhaps mindfulness and happiness and spirituality are mutually exclusive to success.
No, thank you. I think, Cody, I think from my perspective, we have to be in service. The best cure for loneliness, which we all are going through, is to be of service. Because when you're in service, you forget it's not about you, it's about we, right? So,
right. And it's interesting, there's this, you get this this helper's high, right? They call it in science, when you do for another. It literally acts on your brain the same way a psychedelic or mind-altering substance would. And it's the best things you could do. If you're not feeling good, just start doing for others. Just start giving for others, because it opens up that channel of connection and it will open up new vitality into your life.
Right. And that's what I think working with you, and I think collaborating with you, we have not known each other for a long time, but I feel I know you.
Yeah, same, right? Brother.
And I feel, and sometimes life is non-linear, right?
Yeah.
It is not like people, if you meet somebody and say, you know what? I feel really comfortable. I know them. You probably did. What was it? And sometimes I realize there's a mystery in this world. And I love there to be magic. Because I realize that only when there's magic is life is beautiful, right? And for me, is I always want to recreate this magic. And I also realize that there is synchronicity in the world. How could all of a sudden me and Cody Blue Snyder have this conversation today? It probably took a million years in the making, right? And it just happened to be in LA, but all timing is perfect.
Right.
Right? You can never force anything. And that's one thing I said, all timing is perfect. And there's a very important saying from Yoga Vasishta. We said, infinite flexibility is the key to immortality, right? And our goal in life is to be infinitely flexible so we can truly be immortal.
I love that. I love that. And it's truly what I've learned doing this work is life is happening for us, not to us.
Yeah.
And if we stop resisting sort of the tides and we just float, it always ends up more beautiful than we ever could have imagined. It's just like the ceremonies you talked about of surrendering and letting go. And what happens after it, ceremony or medicine ceremonies like this are the most uncomfortable when you resist.
Right.
If you just surrender, the discomfort washes over, and on the other side is bliss and unity and oneness, and it's truly is, that's where the medicine is, but that's where the healing is within those beats of resistance. You know, so once we learn not to resist, and you know, it's there's all the magic right behind it.
Resistance to the present is stress. I think Deepak says that.
You know? Oh, what is that? Say that again.
Resistance to the present is stress.
I love that.
You know,
I love that. And it's easier said than done, but we're just trying to become conscious of the programs, of the unconscious programs that are causing that resistance. And that's what we're here to heal. And that's what we're here to talk about. And brother, I'm so grateful that we got to do this. I want to do one thing before I serenade you in love and send you on your way. So if you have, before you leave this rock, you got one thing to say to the world, what you got one song to sing? What do you got for us?
You know, my other thing, I call myself the warrior monk, and I say the warrior always helps the helpless, and the monk provides hope to the hopeless. A world where no one is helpless or hopeless is a world I imagine, and I'll do everything I can for the rest of my journey on this planet to make sure no one ever feels helpless or hopeless.
Well said. Well said. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. To be continued, we'd love to have you back whenever you'd like.
I'm glad to be of service anytime.
We're your allies, brother. Thank you for being a part of the Awakened Underground. And we're your allies. You need anything, you hit up your gang.
Got it.
And we got you.
Got okay. The Sangha.
Yeah. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thank you for listening to the Awakened Underground podcast. We appreciate your time, attention, and support. Please be sure to hit the subscribe button. Throughout the season, we will be interviewing doctors, scientists, shamans, thought leaders, and celebrities who work with psychedelic medicines and are ready to come out from the underground to share their stories of healing with the world and what these medicines have to teach us about the true nature of reality. The Awakened Underground is a production of Calvary Audio in association with iHeartRadio. The Awakened Underground is created and hosted by Cody Blue, directed by Tanya Dahl, produced by Cody Blue and Jeff Apple, executive produced by Dana Burdetti and Keegan Rosenberger, co-executive produced by Jason Seagraves and Brandon Morgan, and a very special thanks to Danielle DeLoreto, Eric Klein, Alexander Chinisi, Armand Zadie, David Grillo of Thank You Plant Medicine, our teachers, First Nations people, our ancestors, our families, and these sacred plants.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.